we present The Future of the Negro Movement, a discussion by Stokely Carmichael and Bayard Rustin. The program is introduced by the moderator, Robert Pervin, of the Rutgers University Labor Center and former director of the League for Industrial Democracy's Leadership Training Institute in Harlem.
The speakers are known to all of you, so I have no great task in introducing them to you. I would just like to say that Stokely Carmichael is presently the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Bayard Rustin is presently the executive director of the A. Philip Randolph Institute. Without anything further, I present to you Mr. Stokely Carmichael.
Thank you and good evening. I was just trying to find out which one belongs to the CIA. So what I wanted to do tonight was to just outline some of the philosophical background from which the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee proceeds, and then to move on into a programmatic approach, which we hope to encounter in the forthcoming years in the country. Some of the quotations that will be read is taken from an article that appeared in the Massachusetts Quarterly Review. It's published by the University of Massachusetts. It came out last week. It deals with the road in which the civil rights movement has taken in the past and what we in SNCC see that it must do now in the future. Traditionally, for each new ethnic group, the route to social and political integration into America's pluralistic society has been through the organization of their own institutions with which to represent their communal needs within the larger society. This is simply stated what the advocates of black power are saying. The strident outcry, particularly from the liberal community, that has been evoked by this proposal can only be understood by examining the historic relationship between the black and white power structure in this country. Blacks are defined by two forces, their blackness and their powerlessness. There have been traditionally two communities in America, the white community, which controlled and defined the forms that all institutions within the society would take, and the black community, which has been excluded from participation in the power decisions that shaped the society and has traditionally been dependent upon and subservient to the white community. This has not been accidental. The history of every institution of this society indicates that a major concern in the ordering and structuring of the society has been the maintenance of the black community in its condition of dependence and oppression. This has not been on the level of individual acts of discrimination between individual whites and individual blacks, but as total acts by the white community against the black community. This fact cannot be too strongly emphasized, that racist assumptions of white superiority have been so deeply ingrained into the structure of the society that it infuses the entire functioning of that society and is so much a part of the national subconscious that it is taken for granted and frequently not even recognized. Let me give an example of the difference between individual racism and institutionalized racism and the society's response to both. When unidentified white terrorists bomb a black church and kill five black children, that is an act of individual racism, widely deplored by most segments of the society. But when in that same city, Birmingham, Alabama, not five, but 500 black babies die each year because of lack of proper food, shelter, and medical facilities, and thousands more are destroyed and maimed physically, emotionally, and intellectually because of conditions of poverty and deprivation in the ghetto, that is a function of institutionalized racism. And it is to that that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee speaks. But the society either pretends it doesn't know of this situation or it is incapable of doing anything meaningful about it. And this resistance to doing anything meaningful about conditions in that ghetto comes from the fact that the ghetto is itself a combination of forces and special interests inside the white community. And the groups that have access to the resources and power to change that situation benefit politically and economically from the existence of the ghetto. It is more than a figure of speech to say that the black community in America is the victim of white imperialism and colonial exploitation. This is, in practical, economic, and political terms, true And for my philosophy friends, it is a truism. There are over 20 million black people compromising 10% of this nation. In SNCC, we feel there are at least 54 million black people in the country, but they won't tell us. They, for the most part, lived in well-defined areas of the country, in the shanty towns and rural black belt areas of the South, and increasingly in the slums of northern and western industrial cities. If one goes into any black community in this country, whether it be in Jackson, Mississippi, Cambridge, Maryland, or Harlem, New York, one will find that the same combination of political, economic, and social forces are at work. The people in the black community do not control the resources of that community, its political decisions, its law enforcements, its housing standards, and even the physical ownership of the land, houses, and stores lie outside that community. It is white power that makes the laws, and it is violent white power in the form of armed white cops that enforce those laws with guns and nightsticks. The vast majority of blacks in this country live in these captive communities and must endure these conditions of oppression because, and only because, we are black and powerless. I do not suppose that at any point the men who control the power and resources of this country ever sat down and designed these black enclaves and formally articulated the terms of their colonial independent status, as was done, for example, by the apartheid government of South Africa, which this country supports. Yet one cannot distinguish between one ghetto and another. As one moves from city to city, it is as though some malignant racist planning unit had done precisely this, designed each one from the same master blueprint. And indeed, if the ghetto had been formally and deliberately planned instead of going spontaneously and inevitably from the racist functioning of the various institutions that combine to make this society, it would be somehow less frightening. The situation would be less frightening because if these ghettos were the result of design and conspiracy, one could understand their similarity as being an artificial and consciously imposed quality, rather than the result of identical patterns of white racism which repeat itself in cities as distant as Harlem is to Watts. Without bothering to list the historic factors which contribute to this pattern, economic exploitation, political impotence, discrimination in employment and education, one can see that to correct this pattern will require far-reaching changes in the basic power relationships and the ingrained social patterns within the society. The question is, of course, what kind of changes are necessary and how is it possible to bring them about? In recent years, the answer to this question, which has been given by a most articulate group of Negroes and their white allies, the liberals of all stripes, has been in the terms of something called integration. According to the advocates of integration, social justice will be accomplished by, and I quote, integrating the Negro into the mainstream institutions of the society from which he has been traditionally excluded, end of quote. It is very significant that each time I've heard this formulation, it has been in terms of the Negro, the individual Negro, rather than in terms of the black community. This concept of integration had to be based on the assumption that there was nothing of value in the black community and that little of value could be created among blacks. So the thing to do was to siphon off the acceptable Negroes into the surrounding middle-class white community. Thus, the goals of the movement for integration was simply to loosen up the restrictions barring the entries of Negroes into the white community. Goals such as public accommodations, open housing, job opportunity on the executive level, which is much easier to deal with than on the unskilled level, around which the struggle took place, are quite simply middle-class goals, articulated by a tiny group of Negroes who had middle-class aspirations. Now, I want to add that I think the press was very important, as they always are, in helping to project things from their own individual assumptions. What they used to say all the time was that SNCC people, for example, left New York and went to Mississippi to integrate. I guess the logical conclusion of that was I left New York to go and sit next to Ross Barnett and Jim Clark. Obviously, that's not what I went to do. What we have been doing in SNCC is we have been fighting against white supremacy, and there is a big difference. I don't want to sit next to Jim Clark. I want to render him impotent over my life. But what the country can't do is to afford to admit that there are white supremacists who are in power inside the country. So they say that we're fighting to integrate, and we never talk about white supremacy. But this is a new day. We're defining our own terms. Incidentally, that is the first necessity of a free people. It is also the first necessity that the oppressor must suspend. That is why when we read our history books, whenever the cavalry, which were the white folk, won a battle, it was called a victory. When the Indians won it, it was called a massacre. This limited class orientation was reflected not only in the program and goals of the civil rights movement, but in its tactics and organization. It is very significant that the two oldest and most, quote, respectable civil rights organizations have I can only say three-fifths of that word, I'm sorry. I think it's constitutions. Which specifically prohibit partisan political activity. The Congress of Racial Equality once did, but changed that clause when it changed its orientation towards black power. But this is perfectly understandable in terms of the strategy and goals of the older organizations. The civil rights movement saw its role as a kind of liaison between the powerful white community and the dependent black community. The dependent status of the black community apparently was unimportant, since it was, if the movement was going to be successful, going to blend into the white community anyway. They made no pretense of organizing and developing institutions of community power in the black community, but in appealing to the conscience of white institutions of power. The posture of the civil rights movement was that of the dependent, the suppliant. The theory was that without attempting to create any organized base of political strength itself, the civil rights movement could be forming coalitions with various of the liberal pressure organizations in the white community, liberal reform clubs, labor unions, church groups, progressive civic groups, and at one time or other, one of the major political parties. We could influence national legislation and then national social patterns. I think we've all seen the limitations of this approach. We have repeatedly seen that political alliances based on appeals to conscience and decency are chancy things, simply because institutions have no conscience outside their own special interest. The political and social rights of blacks have been and always will be negotiable and expendable the moment they conflict with the interest of our allies. If we do not learn from history, we are certainly doomed to repeat it. And this is precisely the lesson we should learn after Reconstruction, particularly concerning the populist movement. Blacks were allowed to register, they were allowed to vote, and they were allowed to participate in politics because it was to the advantage of a powerful white ally to promote this, notably Tom Watson. But this was the result of white decisions. And it was ended by another white man's decision before any political base powerful enough to challenge that decision could be established in the southern black community. And that same man was Tom Watson. Thus, at this point in the struggle, blacks have no assurance save a kind of idiot optimism and faith in a society whose history is one of racism, that if it were to become necessary, even the painfully limited gains thrown to the civil rights movement by the Congress will not be revoked as soon as a shift in political sentiments should occur. The major limitation of this approach was that it tended to maintain the traditional dependence of blacks and of the movement. We depended upon the goodwill and support of various groups within the white community whose interests were not always compatible with ours. To the extent that we depended on the financial support of other groups, we were vulnerable to their influence and domination. Also, the program that evolved out of this coalition was really limited and inadequate in the long term, and one which affected only a small group of selected Negroes. Its goal was to make the white community accessible to qualified Negroes, and presumably each year a few more Negroes armed with their passports, a couple of university degrees, would escape into middle-class America and adopt the attitudes and lifestyles of that group, and one day the Harlems and Watts would stand empty, a tribute to the success of integration. This is simply neither realistic nor is it particularly desirable. You can integrate communities, but you assimilate individuals. Even if such a program were possible, its results would be not to develop the black community as a functional and honorable segment of the total society with its own cultural identity, life patterns, and institutions, but to abolish it, the final solution to the Negro problem in this country. Karl Marx reminds us that the working class is the first class that ever wanted to abolish itself. If one were to listen to some of our moderate Negro leaders, you would assume that the Negro race was the first race that wanted to abolish itself. The fact is that what must be abolished is not the black community, not the black community, but what must be abolished is the dependent colonial status that has been inflicted upon it by the white community. The racial and cultural personality of the black community must be preserved, and the community must win its liberation while preserving its cultural integrity. This is the essential difference between integration as it is currently practiced and the concept of black power. And what has the movement for integration accomplished to date? That the black graduating from MIT with a doctorate degree will have better job opportunities available to him than even Linda Bird Johnson. But the rate of unemployment in the black community is steadily increasing, while that in the white community decreases. More educated Negroes hold executive-type jobs in major corporations and federal agencies than ever before, but the gap between white income and black income has almost doubled in the last 20 years. More suburban housing is available to Negroes if they can stand the rocks, but housing conditions in the ghetto is steadily declining. While the infant mortality rate of this city is at its lowest rate ever in the city's history, the infant mortality rate of Harlem is steadily climbing. There has been an organized national resistance to the Supreme Court's order to integrate the schools, including IS 201, and the federal government has not acted to enforce that order. Less than 15% of black children in the South attend integrated schools, and black schools, which the vast majority of black children still attend, are increasingly decrepit, overcrowded, understaffed, inadequately equipped, and inadequately funded. And that is to whom the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is now addressing itself. This explains why the rate of school dropouts is increasing among black teenagers, who then express their bitterness, hopelessness, and alienation in the only means they have, by imitating this country via violence. As long as people in the ghettos of our large cities feel that they are victims of the misuse of white power, without any way to have their needs represented, and these are frequently simple needs, to ask college graduates who are social workers not to kick down the door at midnight looking for shoes, we will continue to have riots. These are not the products of black power, but of the absence of any organization capable of giving the community the power, the black power it needs to deal with its problems. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee proposes that it is now time for the black liberation movement to stop pandering to the fears and anxieties of the white middle class in an attempt to earn its goodwill. And it is time for them to return to the ghetto and to organize these communities to control themselves. This organization must be attempted in northern and southern urban areas, as well as in the rural black belt counties of the South. The chief antagonist to this organization is, in the South, the overtly racist Democratic Party, and in the North, the equally racist and just as corrupt big city machines. The standard argument presented against independent political organization is, but you are only 10%. You ought to ask Mr. Spivak about that. I cannot see what the relevance of this observation is, since no one is talking about taking over the country, but taking control over our own communities. The fact is that the black population, 10% or not, is very strategically placed, ironically, because of segregation. What is also true is that blacks have never been able to utilize their full voting potential of our numbers. Where we could vote, and the country was liberal enough to let us start voting last year, that was very white of them. Where we could vote, the case has always been that the white political machine stacks and gerrymanders the political subdivisions in black neighborhoods so that true voting strength is never reflected in political strength. Would anyone think, looking at the distribution of political power in this borough, Manhattan, would you ever think that blacks represented 60% of the population here? Just as often, the effective political organization in black communities is absorbed by tokenism and patronage, the time-honored practice of giving certain office to selected Negroes. The machine thus creates a little machine which is subordinate and responsive to it in the black community. These Negro political leaders are really vote deliverers, more responsible to the white machine and the white power structure than the community they allegedly represent. Thus is the white community able to substitute patronage control for the audacious black power inside the black community. This is precisely what President Johnson tried to do even before the Voting Rights Act of 1966 was passed. The National Democrats made it quite clear, crystal clear as a matter of fact, that the measure was intended to register Democrats, not Negroes. The president and top officials of the Democratic Party called in about 100 selected Negro leaders from the Deep South. Nothing was said about changing the policies of the racist state parties. Nothing was said about repudiating such leadership figures as Eastland and Ross Barnett in Mississippi or George Wallace of Alabama. What was said was simply, and I quote, "Go home and organize your people into the local Democratic Party. Then we'll see about poverty money and appointments, my fellow Americans." We must organize black community power to end these abuses and to give the black community a chance to have its needs expressed. A leadership which is truly responsible not to the white press and the white power structure, but to the black community must be developed. A leadership which will recognize that its powers lies in the unified and collective strength of the black community. This will make it difficult for the white leadership group to conduct its dialogue with individuals who are called Negro leaders in terms of patronage and prestige, and will force them to talk to the community's representatives in terms of real power, black power. The single aspect of the Black Power program that has come into the most criticism is this concept of independent organization. This is represented as third partyism, which has never worked, or a withdrawal into black nationalism and isolation, which obviously leads to reverse racism, whatever that means. If such a program is done, it will not have the effect of isolating the black community, but the reverse. When the black community is able to control its local office and negotiate with other groups from a position of organized strength, the possibility of meaningful political alliances on specific issues will be increased. That is a rule of politics, and there's no reason why it should not operate here. The only difference is that we will have the power to define the terms of these alliances. The next question usually is, so, can it work? Can the ghettos in fact be organized? The question is that this organization must be successful because there are no viable alternatives, not the war on poverty, which was at its inception limited to dealing with effects rather than causes and has become simply another source of machine patronage. Integration is meaningful only to a small chosen class within the community who forget they are Negroes. The revolution in agricultural technology in the South is displacing the rural black community into northern urban areas. Both Washington, D.C. and Newark, New Jersey have black majorities. The inner city in most urban areas is already predominantly black. And with the white rush to suburbia, blacks in the next three decades will control the hearts of our great cities. These areas can become either concentration camps with a bitter and volatile population whose only power is the power to destroy, or organized and powerful communities able to make constructive contributions to the total society. Without the power, the black power, to control our lives, our communities, without effective political institutions through which to relate to the total society, these communities will exist in a constant state of insurrection. That is a choice that this country will have to make. Thank you.
The next speaker is Baird Rustin.
It is extremely important that we meet tonight to debate the question, where do we go from here? But it seems to me that before we can do that with any sense of direction, it is equally important that we have a clear idea of what the nature of the American society is today in regard not only to the Negro, but to the poor in our society. Yes, everyone could be all kinds of forces for public accommodations, because it didn't cost this society anything. Millions of people rose up and supported the rights of Negroes for freedom. They marched in Washington. They fought to get bills passed. But when the revolution addressed itself to the problems of housing, to the problems of adequate education, to the problems of jobs, this society was faced with a very different proposition than the hoorah for Negro dignity. For basic in the demands of the Negro people today is a fundamental challenge to this society. We are asking, first of all, for what this society does not want to hear: a redistribution of wealth. We are asking, in addition to a redistribution of wealth, freedom for the Negro people. Now the revolt, the basic revolt around civil rights in this nation, is not that the Negroes are asking for their rights and the power to organize to demand those rights. That is not the basic factor. The basic factor is that if this society is to deliver to black men and to the white poor, indeed, what they justly deserve, then this society must dig deep and be prepared to make revolutionary change in its economic and social life. And nothing short of that. And nothing short of that proposition will be meaningful. You cannot, in fact, make decent schools in this society without the expenditure of billions of dollars. You cannot deal with the problem of housing for the poor, to say nothing of attempting to deal with the housing of the discriminated against black poor, without billions of dollars, so many billions being invested in housing as to be revolutionary. The society cannot put men back to work in the face of prejudice, in the face of automation, in the face of cybernation, with business as usual. Something fundamental and deep will have to be done. And the splintering, there were many people who marched in Washington waving the flag of dignity on August 28th, 1963, who will not today march in the street for the kind of basic and revolutionary change which is needed, because they are now faced with something for which they are going to have to pay, and for which they are going to have to lose privilege, and for which they are indeed going to have to share decision-making and power with others. Since 1954, that year which was to be the banner year that was to usher in freedom for black men, the unemployment amongst Negro adults has doubled. The unemployment amongst Negro teenagers is three times that of whites. The unemployment amongst Negro girls is four times that of whites. The same old ghettos are there 12 years after the Supreme Court decision, with more rats and more roaches and more despair. There are more Negro children in segregated classrooms than there were in 54. And in the face of this, people turn to Negro leaders, as Senator Ribicoff turned to me in Washington the other day, wanting to know what we could do to maintain order. I told the senator he ought not to present that question to me. It was an insult. Those There is no way in this nation, and we had better face it, to stop rioting, to stop the throwing of Molotov cocktails, to stop Negroes from tearing things up, and for a very simple reason. Where there is justice, there can be order. And where there is injustice, social disorder is inevitable. It is not Whitney Young, nor Roy Wilkins, nor even my friend Stokely, Mr. Carmichael. I don't want to give you anything more than you deserve. It is not that if Negro youngsters tomorrow riot in our streets, it is not we who are responsible, but this society which will not give them their just due. And the young Negroes of Watts were right in saying to me and Martin King, what the hell are you niggas who made it doing out here asking us to keep still? If there is disorder now, one of the chief reasons will be that the President of the United States himself, Lyndon B. Johnson, is now cutting the little carrot that we had in OEL and destroying CDGM in Mississippi. The administration itself is responsible for the disorder. And it is not those who cry black power, even where I disagree with it, who are responsible for the disorder. For this society is daily teaching Negroes that the only way to get anything is through disorder. Dr. King is in Chicago. He works for a year. The Daily Machine gives him nothing. A group of Negro youngsters want the right to go out and cool themselves in the summer, and they open the fire hoses, and the police close them, and they open them, and the police close them, and they open them, and the police beat some heads. Then they turned and started beating heads. And I want you to note that less than 48 hours when they had rioted in the streets, that same structure which would not give King a single thing gave these youngsters $8 sprinklers plus swimming pools. In Watts, no hospital, no transportation system, and then they riot. No jobs. Those pretty little houses you see in Watts with palm trees growing in front of them and that nice green lawn doesn't mean a damn thing. In those houses there are an average of 15 people living. So crowded is that ghetto. And then they riot. And as one of the young men from Watts said to me, Mr. Rustin, you can say what you want, but we won, baby. Why, I say, young man, when you have destroyed the Negro community, have you won? And he said, we asked the mayor to come before. We told him we needed a hospital before. We told him we needed a transportation system before. After we issued our manifesto, and I was stupid enough to ask him if I could see a copy of it. After we issued our manifesto, he said, the mayor came, the governor came, they're talking about a transportation system, they're talking about a hospital, and then he said to me, quiet like, so everybody could hear. And man, when you go out in that street, be careful. Because they got so many sociologists, social workers, psychologists, city planners out there, baby, you're going to trip over them if you ain't careful. Now, I maintain that the Negro people are sufficiently developed so that if there is frustration for them, they will not engage in turning that inevitable frustration in on themselves, as we did for hundreds of years in violence by destroying ourselves. The young Negroes today will not do that. This society had better see that they will not do it, and that they are going to do what Dollard pointed out in his book at Yale. Where there is frustration, there will be aggression. And they are going, as developing the black personality, to divert that aggression outside and not to themselves. This is a very, very serious proposition. I maintain, however, my friends, that nothing short of concrete program addressing itself to the revolutionary needs of this society can be effective. I also believe that it is imperative, as I have attempted over 30 years to help to do, that the black people in this country organize themselves to express their needs and aspirations. But it is not enough to express that need and aspiration merely in psychological terms. The nature of the society is determined by the economic and social order. And white people will view Negroes, and Negroes will view themselves, to the degree that they are an integral part of that social economic struggle which directs this nation toward basic change. And the A. Philip Randolph Institute, in issuing the Freedom Budget, issued it for all Americans. And I want to explain to Mr. Stokely why we issued it for all Americans. First of all, because we know, and I once, in debating Malcolm X, told Malcolm, you know, Malcolm, I said, Malcolm, my problem is not that I don't understand the white people and how devilish they can be. I think you talk that way, but you don't really understand it, because if you really did understand how dangerous they could be, you would be a little more careful. Now, I want to say to you, my friends, we issued the Freedom Budget for all Americans not only for the moral reason that I am opposed to any human being suffering poverty, but also for a fundamental tactical reason. This society, where you need billions of dollars to deal with the kinds of problems we had, I am very realistic. It is not going to do anything special for Negroes. Right. And therefore, the Freedom Budget is for all Americans, in the hope that if we can get a movement about the 67% of the poor who are white, we also may benefit. Now, my friends, I would like to point out to you what I think is the concrete program for getting at the nature, deeply, of the social and economic problems which we face. I, any day, will hand Mr. Johnson back the whole war on poverty and OEO if he will pass a $2 minimum wage, thereby making it possible for the poor to earn millions and millions of dollars, which they deserve and are working for, but are not getting. I am for full employment. A society which says 4% unemployment is natural and good for the economy is made up of a leadership with rocks in its head. All those unemployed who think that 4% unemployment is good for the society, raise your hands and I will show you some fools. We need, in the face of cybernation and automation, to redefine the nature of work. You cannot say to people simply because this society has crippled them, well, we can't find work with you because you're crippled. You look up and you say, hell, man, you crippled me. What is this game? Therefore, we must redefine the nature of work. As the machines take more and more work away from people, we have got to find new methods of work for which men can be decently and adequately paid. My friends, there are a great number of crippled people in this society, psychologically and physically. They cannot work, and they ought not to work. And for them, and only for those who are so crippled, I recommend the guaranteed annual income. The rest of us who are able to work ought to have a guaranteed annual wage, which is adequate to meet the needs of families and children. There is something basically wrong with a society which says if you're crotchety, and I'm getting too near that age to take it easy, if you're over 65, we'll give you partial medical care. And the rest of you find it wherever you can. If Sweden and Denmark and Britain, who are a hell of a lot poorer than we are, can see to it that anyone who is sick gets total medical care, then what is wrong with us? Now, these are some of the ideas that I think we have to have. But, my friends, I repeat that freedom for black men has to spring from one place, and that is how the economic and social order is established, organized, what its objectives and priorities are. Just as discrimination and segregation have proceeded from a different kind of social and economic order and priorities. Now, I want to make it quite clear. I am for Negroes organizing themselves into Negro institutions where it makes sense. A. Philip Randolph, whom I highly respect, organized the Black Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. That is one of the reasons that Randolph, over the years, eternally emerged as a great figure, because he had at his back a sizable group of black people who were organized. It wasn't a simple happenstance. He had an economic base in the Negro community behind him. But I do not honestly believe, having said that, that then the black power people go on to add to it what is essential. I do not agree, Stokely, that you have yet dealt with the problem of with whom and under what circumstances do you make alliances, and what segments in this society which are organized and have some power that you are prepared to align yourself with. I am not talking about 15 students from the University of Pennsylvania, black or white. I'm talking about elements in this society which in fact manipulate, because they possess, power. Now, that's okay, baby. They'll find me. Mr. Stokely says that coalitions are made on mutual interest.
But of course, what else? You don't make coalitions as a love match. Dr. King in Birmingham and the white businessmen made a coalition to get rid of Bull Connor. They got rid of him. Neither of them could have done it alone. The point is, always in a society, you must ask the question, who now, because of his own interest, is prepared to cooperate with me because of my interest, because I'm not going to cooperate with anybody else who isn't operating in my interest. This is the hub. And what I would like Stokely to make clear to me are two things. As concretely as I have tried to outline these 8 steps that the Freedom Budget stands for, I would like to hear from him A, B, C, D. Not in psychological terms about the dignity of the Negro community, but about program, social and economic. You will have time. Now, right. Second. You will have time. Now, right. Secondly, if it is true that you can make coalitions only on the basis of mutual interest, it is also true that somebody will have an interest in common with you today, but not tomorrow. And to reject them because they do not have an eternal interest with you is not to be political. It is to deal in frustration, politics. Now, I happen to believe that everything that will help the black people in this nation is rooted in how we deal with the social and economic situation. And I submit again, 1/10 of the people in a democratic society cannot alone make such determinations. They must have other forces in the society moving with them. And those forces will be made up of American people. There is not an institution in this country which does not have segregation and discrimination in it. If I reject people for that reason, I have nowhere to look for help. And therefore, I am convinced that the best elements in the Catholic, Jewish, and Protestant faith must be a part of this force that is needed to go to Congress to extract the billions of dollars that the Freedom Budget calls for. I know that the labor movement is not perfect, but I am not going to reject the best elements in it because there are elements in it which are not good. I say they should come along. I maintain that we ought not reluctantly to keep white people guessing, Stokely, as to whether they are welcome in the movement. We ought to send forth a proclamation saying we need them, because we need anyone we can get to give strength and support to the basic problem of social change in this country, which is basically a revolutionary matter.
I'm going to ask first for a question for Mr. Carmichael, and then I'm going to ask for a question for Mr. Rustin. I'll take the first question now for Mr. Carmichael.
Gentleman there.
I'd like to just present the question that was already put by Van Rustin as to a program. If we can agree on the causes are such that we can't argue against them. What we are going for, we might agree with, but what about a program to get there? Who are the people that will participate?
Right.
The question is for Mr. Carmichael to comment on what is the program.
Well, I thought the question was deeper than that. It also went into who do we coalesce with. Is that what you asked? But I want to try to be very crystal clear in my thinking about this. I think the assumption of some of the people who are articulating the coalition politics make a assumption which we in SNCC do not make. That is, they coalesce with groups who start from the basic assumption that what is good for the United States is also good for black people. And that is not true. It is not true. So that is to say that if you are to coalesce with somebody who's in the power structure, is to assume that what they're moving for is good for them, good for the U.S., and good for you. It is not true. We must now turn that statement around to say we want what is good for black people. That's what we need to say. Now, I can go down and explain that very clearly. Number one, slavery was good for this country. It wasn't good for black people. The war in Vietnam is good for this country, baby. And I'm out here to tell you, baby, the way they carry on and the way they carry on that war, taking 30% of us, that's black urban removal. So it ain't good for us. And that we must now move one step further to say and to agree with Mr. Rustin, as he so intellectually pointed out, that the overall economic program of this country in the last 20 years has widened the gap between black and white income. So it is crystal clear in the minds of SNCC people that the overall economic of this program is not good for black people in this country. That means now that black people must begin to articulate their needs and see which groups of the so-called good forces are willing to coalesce with them. That's a big difference. And it is crystal clear to point out that in the past, the coalition forces that Mr. Rustin points out have been coalition forces, as Mr. Danzig quite clearly pointed out in his article, Live Commentary, are coalition forces of leaders who were made by the white press that had no base of black people underneath them. It is absolutely ludicrous for anyone to say the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee does not have a program. It was we who organized the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And that what we did in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was to show that when the question of coalition came up, if one did not have power, racism was going to rule. As the National Democratic Party clearly pointed out to us in 1964, they picked the racist over the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. It was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that organized the Lowndes County Freedom Party, a party that is run, owned, and controlled by poor people in the South. They happen to be black. That is not exclusive, it is inclusive, because they have been excluded from the political arena in the South. So they're now building an inclusive political philosophy which would include them. It's a big difference. And that we must point at one further thing with this coalition theory. That if you talk about economics, it is crystal clear to me that the people with whom the coalition people coalesce are people who are economically secure. Black people are economically insecure. You don't coalesce like that. It is crystal clear to me that people who are economically insecure cannot coalesce with people who are economically secure. The groups that Mr. Rustin named are economically secure. The Catholics, the labor unions, they're fighting for themselves, not for us. Their interests are obviously not ours, so you can't coalesce with that. You now have to find a group who's economically insecure and coalesce with them. We have urged in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that we start organizing poor whites because they're economically insecure. We have started a project. We've done that work, started in Tennessee and Kentucky. We're starting to build those forces with whom we can coalesce because there are very few forces inside the power structure with whom we can coalesce. Now then, there's one other thing, because that question then leads to what is called by some people around the country green power. And that, I think, is just begging the question of black power. Because what these people are saying is we want money. We don't care how we get it. We don't care if the United States exploits South Africa, fights a war and kills people in Vietnam. We just want some money. And it is crystal clear to me that the people who are advocating black power are advocating the most humanist position in this country, because we want to question where that money is coming from. That's what we want. So that our program is to begin to internalize inside the black community, to begin to develop a political base where you can have forces inside the black community, and then move to a position where you can coalesce with those forces once you have built a base and decided what is your needs. This country is not going to get rid of ghettos just because some people say so, because the people who own ghettos are the most powerful people inside this country. Inside this country. That is not a rule of politics, it is a truism. Now I'd like to read one quote, just the last quote, in terms of Mr. Rustin's position, because I thought the Student Nonviolent Coordinating was quite clear in terms of white people. This is a quote, it's not mine, incidentally. It was made by Mr. A. Philip Randolph. We shall not call upon our white friends to march with us. There are some things Negroes must do alone. Now, the March on Washington movement is an all-Negro movement, but it is not anti-white, anti-American, anti-labor, anti-Catholic, or anti-Semitic. It is simply pro-Negro. Its validity lies in the fact that no one will fight as hard as Negroes to remove and relieve pain as he who suffers from it. Negroes are the only people who must take the initiative and assume the responsibility to abolish it. Jews must and do lead the fight against anti-Semitism. Catholics must and lead the fight against anti-Catholicism. Labor must battle against labor laws and practices. Mr. Randolph made that statement in 1945 when he called for his March on Washington. Things have not changed today.
The gentleman who is... The question is, Mr. Rustin, do you believe that whites could do more good by working in their own communities to remove white racism?
I believe that that a great need among young white people, and I've said this over and over in talking to young whites, is that just as SNCC put on overalls and went to the Negroes of Mississippi to help them, that young whites ought to put on chinos and go into these ghettos where the whites are acting up, where they don't understand the economic nature of their problems, where there is no movement, and try to relieve the Negro community from a total burden by being the only segment of our society in action and getting these whites to move, to begin to think, to see the problem. Our problem would be infinitely simpler if the white poor were in motion, but they are not. I agree, therefore, that this would be a good thing to do. But the opposite side of that coin is not to shut them out if they have a propensity to it to operate in other areas. Because I don't believe that ultimately that is good for our society. In the same way, I think that as Negroes, we have to fight the powers that be in order to create new political power for Negroes. But we also have an internal job to do amongst Negroes. We have to fight on both sides, they have to fight on both sides.
Did everyone hear the question? Okay.
In the first place, I want to say that while my name does appear on the Freedom Budget as a representative of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee reconsidered and sent a telegram asking that our name be withdrawn from the Freedom Budget. And that is simply because to fall into the trap of supporting those institutions depends upon the fact that in order to get the money, the Freedom Budget automatically supports the war in Vietnam. And that what is needed now is to begin to support black people in their move for liberation. The question isn't to be raised by us as to what is good for black people is good for the country. It is for white people to raise that, whether what is good for us is good for the country. Now, our demands are crystal clear. Housing, jobs, schools, decent life, and the right to control our communities. That simply stated what we're saying. Now, if that is good for the country, good for us, then we think it should be good for the country. But that, too, is limited because we move internationally in our scope. We see that this country has oppressed and exploited the non-white world wherever it has been. And so to hook up with those countries that exploit our black brothers is to enjoy the sweat and to enjoy the money that comes from a black man in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, in Vietnam, in Latin America, in South America, in the Philippines, in Puerto Rico, you name it, they claim it.
Take a question from Mr. Rustin, gentleman right there.
How do you interpret the defeat of the civilian review board as it relates to the minority groups in the city, such as the Negro and the Puerto Rican?
The question is, how do I interpret the defeat of the Civilian Review Board as it affects Negroes and Puerto Ricans in New York City? I'm other minorities.
Well, I believe that you have here a very clear operation of a political phenomenon which is both racist and not racist. The reality is that whenever you put up to the people the right to vote on a proposition, they almost invariably vote on it wrong. Whether you're dealing with labor legislation, whether you're dealing with progress, whether you're dealing with the education of their school children, they will invariably want to decrease and defeat the school bond. And I think that that was in operation here. I think it was a great tragedy for the city. Negroes and Puerto Ricans and others, we've been through a hell of a lot and we know how to make our peace ultimately with the police. The tragedy was for New York, which gave people the feeling of hope that they would have the opportunity to have their cases reviewed by something other than police, and then saw it withdrawn. That had to bring about more frustration and more of a feeling by minority groups that this society just doesn't care about them. The tragedy, therefore, for me was for the whole society, not merely for minority groups.
All right, sir.
This is obviously very clear that white America is not going to meet our demands for better houses, better schools.
Can we have your question, please?
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
There is the idea in black communities all over the nation, you know as well as I do, that serious consideration is being given to the concrete idea of beginning to build a nation. We have this in 1949 to show determined people can build a nation. What do you think about the nation-building idea?
What do you think about the nation-building idea?
Great.
Well, I'm not sure we state it that way in SNCC. What we say is that out of the ghettos, it is the job of the young blacks to build communities. Now, I'm not quite sure I understand your question in terms of building nations. Now, you mean a separate nation? Or? Yeah, I'm not sure. I didn't hear the whole thing.
No, about the nation, young blacks are talking about building a nation on the outside of the continental United States. We have the
evidence
to prove that it can't be done in 1949. We're saying that if our demands are not met in terms of housing, schools, better jobs, and other things, then the next step is that we have to begin to organize ourselves, build a nation on the outside of this continental United States to save our lives. I want you to comment on that nation-building idea and that concept.
Well, I just think that our parents struggled too hard and built this country that we should just give it to them. Our sweat is put into this country and that we just gonna have to fight to share in it because it's ours. Our sweat built it.
All right, a question for Mr. Rustin, you, sir.
Mr. Rustin, you just said that sometimes have to give people a choice to vote for and to vote wrong. Would you say that when President Johnson was nominated to run for, he should not have been nominated?
Repeat it, I think.
The question is that I said that sometimes when people vote, they vote wrong. Did I think that Mr. Johnson shouldn't have been elected? Leaving aside your sentiments on Mr. Johnson, ladies and gentlemen, the point I was trying to make is that if you put to voters the question of progressive legislation, they almost always do more badly than their representatives would do in city councils, state legislatures, and in the federal government. That is just a statement of fact on social legislation. And you can see it through the 2-1 vote in California on Proposition 14. You can see it wherever labor legislation has come up, and as I said, in schools. Now, in regard to President Johnson, all I can say is that I could not decide to vote for President Johnson in 1964, in 1966. And I took the position on President Johnson then, which I might say has been somewhat modified, that Mr. Randolph took. When somebody said to Mr. Randolph, this is very unusual for you. You are endorsing a candidate, Johnson. Mr. Randolph said, sorry, gentlemen, I am not necessarily endorsing Johnson. I am endorsing sanity as against insanity. And I think that's the proposition we were faced with then. I think the proposition we're faced with, all right, if anybody wants to think Barry Goldwater was sane, I have no objections.
A question for Mr. Carmichael.
Yes.
We can't hear
you. I'm totally against integration.
The question is whether or not I'm totally against integration. We have said in SNCC time and time again, integration is totally irrelevant. If people want to integrate, that is their problem. But that what we have to recognize is that this is not a struggle for black people to sell their blackness to get into white communities. It's a struggle for black people to have power.
Right.
What that means is that you don't need white people to do good or sympathize with you. What they really need to do is do good to the white community and sympathize with them, because they have oppressed and exploited us. We have not done anything to them. So that question is totally irrelevant. If people want to integrate, they should have the right of free association. White people stop them.
Question for Mr. Rustin from the balcony.
Mr. Rustin, given that the Negro needs economic and social life, does he not also have a need for organization? And if so, how do you suggest to familiarize this stranger to organization?
Repeat the question.
Yeah.
I didn't get it.
Yeah. The question was that if Mr. Rustin believes that the Negro has a need for organization, how does he suggest that he lead the stranger, I guess you mean the Negro, to organization?
I maintain that the Negro is no stranger to organization. Now, this gives me a chance to tell it like it is. When Negroes were not permitted to worship in churches in this country, we didn't sit around moping. We established the AME Church in 1794. When Negroes were not permitted in slave time to bury their dead individually, but to throw them into a dump, we came up with what you want to know from Porgy and Bess as plate burial. You put a plate on the poor slave's chest, and the slaves went around finding whatever they could,
pennies, nickels, and dropped into it and buried him. When the Metropolitan Insurance Company would not give us the right to be insured, we set up our own insurance companies in this community. When it was impossible for us to get any social security, we set up the Elks and the Masons, and they may not have done as well as I would have liked, but they protected their people against this sort of thing. Right. When... when A. Philip Randolph was asked by trade unionists, "Who the hell do you think you are to speak for Negro trade unions and for the Negroes in this nation?" Randolph didn't sit back and cry in his beer, which he doesn't drink. Randolph established the Negro American Labor Council. Now, I'm trying, love. Now, the problem is that even the storefront church recognizes a need and is a fantastic institution. Many Negroes coming out of Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama who don't know their way around. The Negro preacher in the storefront church may be taking a few pennies now and then, but he's putting back into dollars great service to those people who otherwise would be completely alien in this city. He helps them to know where to go and how to get on relief if they need it, and how to get off relief when they can, and how to take care of their children. Man, somebody is mistaken. The Negro has more of an ability to organize. The very fact that we're still living after 200 years.
You have heard a discussion of the future of the Negro movement. The participants were Stokely Carmichael and Baird Rustin. The moderator was Robert Fervin of the League for Industrial Democracy, which sponsored this discussion. The talk was held in December of 1966. This is Mike O'Dell for Pacifica Radio.
The program was produced and recorded at WBAI, Pacifica Radio, in New York, and it was brought to you over KPFA and KPFB, Pacifica Radio, broadcasting to most of Northern California from Berkeley.